Hello, this is Elizabeth Ortel, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 29th issue of the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the front page of October 29th, U.S. military kills 14 more people accused of smuggling drugs on boats. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said that the three strikes hit four boats in international waters and that there had been one survivor. The Trump administration launched another round of deadly strikes on vessels it accused of smuggling drugs, killing 14 people in four boats in its growing military campaign off the Central and South American coast, Defense Secretary Peter Hegseth said Tuesday. Mr. Hegseth said that the strikes, three of them, took place on Monday in international waters and that there had been one survivor. They bring the overall death toll to 57 in the campaign, which began in September. A U.S. military official discussing operations on the condition of anonymity said the lone survivor was picked up in waters near the coast of Mexico and Guatemala. Mr. Hegseth said that Mexican search and rescue authorities had accepted the case and assumed responsibility for coordinating the rescue, but he did not release further details. The four vessels were known by intelligence apparatus, transiting along known narco-trafficking routes and carrying narcotics, Mr. Hegseth said in a post on social media, announcing the strikes and accompanied by a video. He said eight men were on the boats in the first, four men were on the boat in the second strike, and three men were on the boat that was struck third. He did not provide geographic details beyond saying the strikes took place in the Eastern Pacific. After launching a series of strikes in the Caribbean near the coast of Venezuela, the Trump administration has more recently directing the U.S. military to strike boats in the Eastern Pacific off the coast of Colombia. Two Air Force B-1 bombers from Texas flew off the coast of Venezuela in international airspace on Monday, the latest effort by the Trump administration to pressure the country's authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro, to leave his nation, two U.S. officials said on Tuesday, discussing operational matters on the condition of anonymity. It was the second time in less than a week that the B-1s have flown such a mission. The long-range B-1 bombers from Dyess Air Force Base in Abilene, Texas, can carry up to 75,000 pounds of guided and unguided munitions, the largest non-nuclear payload of any aircraft in the Air Force arsenal. Earlier this month, at least two B-52 bombers from Louisiana flew for several hours off the Venezuelan coast in international airspace in what one senior U.S. official called a show of force. The B-52s can carry dozens of precision-guided bombs. At roughly the same time, an elite Army Special Operations Aviation Unit conducted flights in the southern Caribbean Sea near the coast of Venezuela. The helicopters, belonging to the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, were flying training missions, not rehearsals for a possible military action inside Venezuela, military officials said. Mr. Hegseth has also ordered the deployment of the aircraft carrier Gerald R. Ford, as well as its accompanying warships and attack planes to waters off Latin America, the Pentagon said last week, in a further dramatic escalation of military might in the region. The Pentagon has not said when the Ford, the Navy's most modern and technologically advanced carrier, will arrive. It is heading to Latin America from the Croatian coast, where it had been on a months-long European deployment. Navy officials have speculated that the arrival could come in the first half of November, depending on weather conditions. It was unclear how hurricane season in the region might affect the heavy American naval buildup. Since late August, The U.S. military has deployed about 10,000 troops to the Caribbean, about half of them on 8 warships and half in Puerto Rico, for what the administration says is a counter-terrorism and counter-narcotics mission. The Ford carries about 5,000 sailors and has more than 75 attack, surveillance, and support aircraft, including F/A-18 fighters. Mr. Hegseth, in his social media post Tuesday, compared the strikes against the boat cartels to America's wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan over the past 24 years. These narco-terrorists have killed more Americans than Al-Qaeda, and they will be treated the same, he said. A broad range of outside experts in laws governing the use of armed force have said the campaign is illegal because the military is not permitted to deliberately target civilians, even criminal suspects, who are not directly participating in armed hostilities. But the Trump administration has asserted that the president has the power to determine, without any authorization from Congress, that drug cartels and those who work for them are enemy combatants. Mr. Trump has falsely asserted that each destroyed boat saves 25,000 American lives. In reality, about 100,000 Americans die each year from drug overdoses, but most of those deaths are fentanyl, which comes from labs in Mexico. South America produces cocaine. Trump bonds with Japan's leader over baseball and U.S. beef. This is another first page article from the New York Times of October 29th. The president and the Japanese prime minister traded compliments in Tokyo, but signaled no major breakthrough in resolving ongoing trade issues. Inside a gold-drenched palace in Tokyo on Tuesday morning, President Trump heaped praise on Sanae Takaichi, Japan's new prime minister, telling her that their countries were allies at the strongest level and vowing to come to Japan's aid on any favors you need. Hours later, delivering a speech to hundreds of American troops aboard an aircraft carrier stationed near Tokyo, Mr. Trump stood side by side with Ms. Takaichi, saying that the two had become very close friends, and adding, "This woman is a winner." The joint appearance, which bore all of the markings of one of Mr. Trump's political rallies, was the capstone of a day in which Mr. Trump and Ms. Takaichi found an easy rapport, watching snippets of the World Series on television, eating lunch at Akasaka Palace in central Tokyo, and sharing stories about their mutual friend Shinzo Abe, the former premier who was assassinated in 2022. But the series of meetings between Mr. Trump and Ms. Takaichi, a hardline conservative who last week became the first woman to serve as Japan's prime minister, delivered little in the way of solutions to some of the contentious trade issues between Washington and Japan. The leaders signed two vaguely worded agreements, one declaring a new golden age of the U.S.-Japan alliance, and another to cooperate on expanding the supply chain for rare earth metals. With both countries essentially agreeing to keep negotiating, Ms. Takaichi bought more time to strategize over how to spend the $550 billion her debt-strapped government has promised to invest as part of an earlier trade deal with the United States. In front of the troops, Mr. Trump, who has been pressing Japan to spend more on defense, said he had approved an order of missiles to supply Japanese F-35 jets. "I've just approved the first batch of missiles," Mr. Trump said to the crowd of service members on Tuesday afternoon. I just wanted to tell Madam Prime Minister they've been waiting for those missiles and we got them here right away. During his speech at the Yokosuka Naval Base, the President said that the car maker Toyota would be investing over $10 billion in American plants, but otherwise the day was short on details. There was no public talk about the major point of contention between the two countries, the details of how Japan intends to spend its promised $550 billion investment into the United States. That pledge was made as part of the trade deal, and in return, Japan received a 15% tariff on its exports, a lower rate than Mr. Trump had initially threatened. Instead, both leaders focused more on what they had in common, a warm relationship with Mr. Abe. Ms. Takaichi is a protege of his, and on Tuesday, she seemed to have some success in using Mr. Abe's playbook to handle a mercurial American president. She even used the same interpreter that Mr. Abe had deployed, a foreign ministry official that Mr. Trump had seemed fond of. They had no issues with chemistry, said Tetsuo Kotani, a professor at Mikkei University in Japan. During Mr. Trump's visit to Tokyo in 2019, Mr. Abe treated the president to a round of golf, barbecue, and a sumo match. Within minutes of meeting Mr. Trump, the new leader showed that she had closely studied Mr. Abe's overtures. During the visit, she gave Mr. Trump a golf bag signed by Hideki Matsuyama, a Japanese professional golfer, and a putter that had belonged to Mr. Abe, along with a map of places within the United States that the Japanese planned to invest money, according to the White House. On his way into Tokyo, Mr. Trump had kept expectations for the visit reasonably low, telling reporters that he had plans to just announce a great friendship while in the Japanese capital. He seemed to have achieved that during a visit to the Akasaka Palace, where he and Ms. Takaichi bonded by watching a bit of the game between the Toronto Blue Jays and the Los Angeles Dodgers. A Japanese favorite and current home of their star player, Shohei Ohtani. Later, the pair spoke warmly of each other before using gold pens to sign Japan is back baseball hats. The two leaders met beneath a grand ceiling featuring a painting of Aurora, the Roman goddess of dawn. They were joined by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Prime Minister Abe often told me about your dynamic diplomacy, Ms. Takaichi told Mr. Trump during their meeting, citing the president's work to broker a ceasefire between Cambodia and Thailand, and his work to do the same between Israel and Hamas. I myself am so impressed and inspired by you, Mr. President. Later, the pair toasted each other at lunch, where American rice was served alongside American beef. Culinary reminders of the pressure the Trump administration has put on the Japanese to buy more American-made goods. Mr. Trump signed the menus afterward for the Japanese delegation, the White House said. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said that Ms. Takaichi had also nominated Mr. Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. The president, who talks frequently about his work to end global conflicts, is fixated on winning the award. The Japanese government said it had no comment on whether it had nominated Trump, based on the Nobel Committee's principle of not making disclosures about the process. Mr. Abe had reportedly done the same during Mr. Trump's first term. For his part, Mr. Trump struck a magnanimous tone with Ms. Takaichi, praising her for becoming the first woman to be elected Prime Minister of Japan, saying it was a big deal. Mr. Trump promised that the United States would offer its help if she ever needed it, a sentiment at odds with his administration's drastic reduction in aid and assistance to other countries. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. I want to just let you know, anytime you have any question, any doubt, anything you want, any favors you need, anything I can do to help Japan, we will be there, Mr. Trump told Ms. Takaichi. We are an ally at the strongest level. Later in the day, Washington and Tokyo said they would work together on shipbuilding, but there were no announcements on how Japan would invest in the United States, a key part of the trade deal the two countries reached in July. The agreement covering critical minerals and rare earths, a sector dominated by China, came after Beijing tightened export controls on rare earth minerals, essential components of everything from semiconductor chips to fighter jets. As part of his six-day swing through Asia, Mr. Trump is scheduled to meet with the Chinese leader in South Korea on Thursday. At the Yokosuka Naval Base, Mr. Trump reiterated the history of Ms. Takaichi's election. Ms. Takaichi said, jumped up and down and pumped her fist. Taking the podium, Ms. Takaichi said that Japan would commit to building up its end of a joint military alliance designed to counter Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific, particularly in the South China Sea. She recalled an appearance at Yokosuka 6 years earlier. Mr. Trump and Mr. Abe, who promised at the time to work together to jointly bolster their respective military presences in the region. I have renewed my determination to carry forward that resolve, she said, and to make the Indo-Pacific free and open so that it will serve as the foundation of peace and prosperity for the entire region. Dozens of states sued Trump administration over planned food stamp cuts. The states petitioned a federal court days after the Agriculture Department said it would not take emergency steps to provide aid during the government shutdown. More than two dozen states sued the Trump administration on Tuesday over its recent refusal to fund food stamps during the government shutdown, as roughly 42 million low-income aid recipients confronted the risk of hunger and financial hardship starting within days. The states, including Arizona, California, and Massachusetts, described the impending cuts as unnecessary and illegal, and they asked a federal judge to force Washington to maintain benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Act, or SNAP, starting on November 1st. Roughly 1 in 8 people in the United States receive food stamps, which average around $187 a month and cost the federal government about $8 billion monthly. Lawmakers must regularly approve money for the program, though SNAP maintains a sizable reserve to cover any emergencies or shortfalls. Many congressional Democrats and Republicans had encouraged the Trump administration to use this funding to preserve food stamps into November, with the government expected to remain closed. But the Trump administration declined on Friday to extend that reprieve, even though the Agriculture Department said weeks ago that it would reprogram money to prevent benefit cuts. In their lawsuit, officials from 25 states and the District of Columbia criticized the Trump administration for that sudden policy reversal, arguing that the federal government had a legal obligation to maintain funding for food stamps, which Congress made permanent in the 1960s. The suit was filed by a mix of Democratic attorneys general and governors from states including Colorado, Illinois, Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Nevada, and North Carolina. If they prevail, it could compel USDA to tap its emergency funds and provide benefits to those states' residents, though the exact scope of any relief would be up to a judge. The states asked the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts to rule by Friday on a motion that could essentially force the administration to tap the contingency funds to pay SNAP benefits next month. The fund, which is estimated to contain $5 billion to $6 billion, would be enough to provide at least partial payments to enrollees. SNAP is one of our nation's most effective tools to fight hunger, and the USDA has the money to keep it running, Letitia James, the Democratic Attorney General of New York, said in a statement. There is no excuse for this administration to abandon families who rely on SNAP or food stamps as a lifeline. Many state leaders warned on Tuesday that a lapse in food stamps could prove financially dire, hammering not only poor families, but the merchants who accept the benefits and the food banks that must step in to help. North Carolina officials said Tuesday that there were 10 counties in the state where 1 in 4 residents was enrolled in SNAP. Jeff Jackson, the Democratic State Attorney General, said at a news conference that nonprofits would not be able to pick up the slack, describing the actions of the Trump administration as a deliberate precipitation of a major hunger crisis. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. The Agriculture Department declined to explain its policy, furnishing only a statement that attacked Democrats over the shutdown. Bottom line, the well has run dry, the agency said in a banner on its public-facing website. At this time, there will be no benefits issued November 1st. In its memo last week, viewed by the New York Times, the Agriculture Department said the contingency fund was not legally available during the government shutdown. The agency said it could tap only the reserve money in limited cases, such as natural disasters. It did not otherwise explain its sudden shift in policy, and it threatened to deny reimbursements to states that try to finance food stamps on their own. Some states have still explored ways to cover the anticipated gap in food aid. In Louisiana, where nearly 20% of the population relies on food stamps, Governor Jeff Landry, a Republican, signed an emergency order ordering the use of state money from the program through November 4th. Local lawmakers are also racing to approve a bill that would allow reserve funds to be used to cover additional missing payments. Broadly, though, Republicans remain adamant that the only sustainable solution rests with Washington. We'll continue to look at every option we have to take care of people in our state, Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders of Arkansas said in an interview. But ultimately, the thing that makes the most sense and is by far not only the best solution but should be happening because it is their responsibility is to have Senate Democrats quit playing games and fund our government. The legal battle over SNAP further evidenced President Trump's political strategy in a shutdown with no clear end. Repeatedly, Mr. Trump has stretched the limits of his powers to blunt the impact of the closure, but only for the agencies, programs, and workers he sees as central to his political agenda. Otherwise, the president has used the stalemate as a cudgel to attack his foes and pursue steep budget cuts that Congress has not adopted. The president has reprogrammed billions of dollars in federal spending to pay border agents and troops while seeking to fire thousands of furloughed federal workers. Mr. Trump has also sourced additional money to assist farmers, a major political constituency, while moving to cut billions of dollars reserved for cities and states led by Democrats. The Trump administration tapped revenue from tariffs to continue providing benefits under another federal nutrition initiative known as WIC, which was similarly at risk in the shutdown. But the president and his aides did not pursue the same strategy with food stamps, a program that Republicans cut, largely by restricting who may participate in it, as part of their recent tax package. The Trump administration first warned states in October about an interruption to food stamps, though it said it was exploring backup plans to help families in need. "We're going to run out of money in 2 weeks," Brooke L. Rollins, the Agriculture Secretary, told reporters at the White House earlier this month. "So you're talking about millions and millions of vulnerable families, of hungry families, that are not going to have access to these programs because of this shutdown." The federal government announced that it would back an effort to build several Westinghouse nuclear reactors, but offered few details. The Trump administration on Tuesday announced a plan to build several new nuclear power plants in what it described as an $80 billion deal to use reactors developed by Westinghouse Electric Company. "It's a big bet on an energy source that utilities and nuclear companies have struggled to develop in the United States over the last several decades, largely because of its high cost and long and complicated construction schedules. But the projected robust growth in electricity demand from data centers for artificial intelligence has encouraged politicians and energy and technology executives to take another look at nuclear power. The new deal is a partnership involving the federal government, Westinghouse, Brookfield Asset Management, and Cameco, a supplier of uranium fuel. Westinghouse is jointly owned by Brookfield and Cameco. This historic partnership with America's leading nuclear company will help unleash President Trump's grand vision to fully energize America and win the global artificial intelligence race," said the Energy Secretary, Chris Wright. President Trump promised a renaissance of nuclear power, and now he is delivering. Under the administration's plan, the new projects would use Westinghouse's AP1000, a reactor most recently used in the United States at a power plant in Georgia. The two reactors built there were the first ones the country has built in decades. The AP1000 reactor was supposed to lead a nuclear renaissance in the early 2000s with plans for roughly 24 new reactors across the country. But just two at the Alvin W. Vogtle Electric Generating Plant in Waynesboro, Georgia, near Augusta, made it to the finish line at a cost of about $35 billion, more than $20 billion more than initial estimates. The reactors were finished years later than planned. Problems with the construction of those reactors were so severe that Westinghouse, then owned by the Japanese company Toshiba, filed for bankruptcy protection in 2017. Various other projects failed, sometimes leaving utility customers on the hook for billions of dollars in costs. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times. on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Various other projects failed, sometimes leaving utility customers on the hook for billions of dollars in cost. This time, the nuclear plants have the backing of the wealthiest industry on the planet, the technology sector, which needs enormous amounts of energy to support its artificial intelligence ambitions. Nuclear power has also been embraced by some liberals and environmentalists on the grounds that reactors do not emit greenhouse gases, unlike natural gas or coal. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom supported extending the life of the Diablo Canyon power plant, the last nuclear power plant in the state, and received aid from the Biden administration for it. Big tech is also backing the development of small modular reactors, conducting research into fusion power, reopening shuttered plants, and extending the life of existing units. Google entered into an agreement on Monday to buy power from a shuttered nuclear power plant in Iowa that its owner, NextEra, an emergency company, plans to restart in 2029. Last year, Microsoft agreed to foot the bill to restart a reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, the site of a cooling failure that led to the partial meltdown of a reactor in 1979. Critics of nuclear projects contend that new reactors are expensive compared with renewable energy sources like solar and wind power. They questioned how the $80 billion would be used and who would fund it. The Trump administration and Westinghouse have provided few details about their plans. The $80 billion is intended to absorb the excess of nuclear, said Mark Cooper, an economic analyst at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. Westinghouse has to find a buyer. There are no buyers at the current price. They still don't recognize that wind and solar are much cheaper. The United States leads the world in nuclear energy production and played a central role in the technology's development. But in the last few decades, it has fallen far behind China, which is building so many reactors that it is expected to have the largest nuclear power capacity by 2030. Connor Teskey, president of Brookfield Asset Management, said in a statement that working with the federal government would help unlock the potential that Westinghouse and nuclear energy can play to accelerate the growth of artificial intelligence in the United States while meeting growing electricity demand and energy security needs at scale. Many of the reactors that China has built in recent years are a version of Westinghouse's AP1000. That country plans to add dozens of reactors, which would bring it closer to the total number of reactors in the U.S. nuclear power plant fleet of more than 90. Other countries have also been pushing for more nuclear power plants. On Tuesday, Japan's Trade Ministry unveiled a list of domestic companies interested in starting projects as part of the $550 billion investment fund that Japan agreed to establish with the United States. The projects included artificial intelligence and a nuclear reactor construction initiative that was expected to be worth up to $100 billion and involve Mitsubishi Heavy and Toshiba. Hurricane Melissa hits Jamaica as one of the most powerful on record. Category 5 storm, whose sustained wind speeds surpassed those of Hurricane Katrina, peeled roofs off homes, swelled rivers, and drew dire warnings from officials. Hurricane Melissa slammed into Jamaica's southwestern coast on Tuesday as one of the strongest storms ever recorded in the Atlantic, beginning what forecasters warned could be a slow path of devastation with catastrophic winds, prolonged rains, and destructive floods and landslides. The Category 5 hurricane made landfall at around noon local time, while sustained winds of 185 miles per hour, just shy of the most intense Atlantic hurricane on record. Fueled by Caribbean water temperatures far warmer than usual, it was more powerful than the peak strength reached by Hurricane Katrina, which pummeled New Orleans in 2005. Veiled by dense curtains of rain and dangerous winds, the full extent of the storm's damage may take hours, if not days, to assess. Already, though, residents reported swelling rivers as well as winds peeling the roofs off hospitals, schools, and homes. Hundreds of thousands had lost power, and officials said they were concerned that not enough people had heeded warnings to seek shelter. Jamaica, this is not the time to be brave, Desmond McKenzie, Jamaica's minister overseeing disaster response, said at a news conference. Don't bet against Melissa. It is a bet we cannot win. The storm was expected to crawl across Jamaica, leaving a trail of destruction, before moving on to Cuba this week. Melissa is the strongest hurricane so far of the 2025 Atlantic season, which began June 1st and ends November 30th, and is the most powerful to strike Jamaica since record-keeping began in 1851. Michael Brennan, the director of the National Hurricane Center, said that gusts of 200 miles per hour were possible in the mountains of Jamaica, where officials were particularly concerned about catastrophic landslides and flash flooding in narrow river valleys. The storm had topped utility poles and inundated streets on Tuesday in the central parish of Manchester, and some residents were trapped by floodwaters in Alligator Pond, a seaside community, according to a local reporter, Sashana Small. Some houses were submerged in Mandeville, forcing residents onto roofs, she said. Ms. Small said that she had sought shelter at a local hotel, but water was coming in under the door of her third-floor room. Officials had anticipated about 50,000 people would move into shelters across the island. But on Tuesday morning, only 6,000 people had evacuated to shelters, according to Mr. McKenzie, Jamaica's Minister for Local Government. Some Jamaicans said they had chosen to stay home rather than go to shelters because they feared they could be assaulted or find inadequate food, water, or bedding. Some said they also wanted to protect their homes from thieves. Verona Sharma, a resident of Spanish Town near Kingston, said she had prepared for the storm by placing locks to hold down her metal roof and filling empty bottles and drums with clean water. Still, the storm had ripped back part of the roof, she said, and electricity had been flickering on and off throughout the night and early morning. She was relying on two candles she had found lying around the house. St. Elizabeth Technical High School in southwestern Jamaica, which was damaged by Hurricane Beryl last year, had severe damage, the principal, Keith Wellington, told Television Jamaica, a Kingston station. Quite a few buildings have lost their roofs, teachers' cottages, some of the main classrooms, he said. The National Hurricane Center warned that winds in Melissa's eye wall, which encircles the eye, were so powerful that they could cause total structural failure. As the storm neared Jamaica, the center urged people in its path to seek shelter, saying it was the last chance to protect your life. About 240,000 people in Jamaica had lost power as of Tuesday morning, mostly in the southern part of the country, where the hurricane made landfall, officials said. Kingston, the capital, was not in the direct path of the storm, but winds were still hammering windows and blowing rain everywhere on Tuesday morning. The streets appeared deserted. The real concern at this point is for the southwestern and central parts of the island, especially key agricultural areas that seem likely to bear the brunt of the storm, Delano Severite, Jamaica's Minister of Industry, Investment, and Commerce, said in an interview. The potential damage there is significant. Most hospitals in Jamaica still had power, although those in the southern parishes of Manchester and St. Elizabeth were relying on generators, Daryl Vaz, the county's energy minister, said on Tuesday morning. Jamaica's water agency warned it may be forced to shut down to prevent mud, silt, and debris from entering the system. Mr. Vaz said he expected that relief flights would be able to land at the main airport serving Kingston as early as Thursday, once the storm had passed. A small country that depends on tourism for about a third of its annual revenue, Jamaica has limited resources to prepare for devastating storms, according to disaster and emergency preparedness experts. At least three people died in connection to preparations for the storm, and 13 others were injured, officials said. Dana Morris Dixon, Jamaica's information minister, said that about 25,000 tourists were in the country. She added that the authorities were coordinating with hotels to ensure their safety. Cruises that were sailing from Florida had moved their itineraries from Jamaica to the Western Caribbean ports of Honduras, Belize, and Mexico. The Pan American Health Organization, which is part of the United Nations, said the storm could cause major public health problems in Jamaica and other nations, including disruptions in medical services, water contamination, disease outbreaks, and mental health issues. In Jamaica, a team of 9 relief workers spent Monday night at a Food for the Poor warehouse in Spanish Town, preparing emergency packages to be delivered after Melissa passes. "We know it's coming," said Kivette Silvera, the head of a response team for Food for the Poor, a nonprofit, noting how the south coast was lashed by Hurricane Beryl last year. Texas sues title lawmakers claiming they hid autism risks. The lawsuit follows claims by President Trump that linked acetaminophen taken by pregnant women to autism, a connection that is unproven. Ken Paxton, the Republican Attorney General of Texas, sued the makers of Tylenol on Tuesday, complaining and claiming that the companies hid the risks of the drug on brain development of children. The lawsuit is the latest fallout from President Trump's claim last month that use of Tylenol during pregnancy can cause autism. That link is unproven. Mr. Paxton filed the suit against Johnson & Johnson, which sold Tylenol for decades, and Kenvue, a spin-off company that has sold the drug since 2023. The Texas lawsuit claims that the companies knowingly withheld evidence from consumers about Tylenol's links to autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The suit also claims that Kenvue was created to shield Johnson & Johnson from liability over Tylenol. This lawsuit is the first by a state that seizes on Mr. Trump's allegations that the use of acetaminophen products like Tylenol during pregnancy could cause neurodevelopmental disorders. The issue has been a long-standing concern among some followers of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the nation's top health official, but the idea gained traction with Mr. Trump's remarks. Kenvue has repeatedly defended Tylenol's safety and rejected Mr. Trump's claims about the drug's use during pregnancy and autism. We will defend ourselves against these baseless claims and will respond per the legal process. Melissa Witt, a spokeswoman for Kenvue, said on Tuesday. We stand firmly with the global medical community that acknowledges the safety of acetaminophen and believe we will continue to be successful in litigation as these claims lack legal merit and scientific support. In other litigation, Johnson & Johnson has said that it had always acted responsibly in warning consumers about Tylenol's proven risk of liver damage when taken in excess. Claire Boyle, a spokeswoman for Johnson & Johnson, said on Tuesday that the company divested its consumer health business years ago, and all rights and liabilities associated with the sale of its over-the-counter products, including Tylenol acetaminophen, are owned by Kenvue. Hundreds of lawsuits in state and federal courts have been filed in recent years by families who claim that their children were diagnosed with autism or ADHD after taking Tylenol during pregnancy. In the largest group of cases filed in federal court, a U.S. judge in New York dismissed the lawsuits, citing a lack of reliable scientific evidence. The plaintiffs are appealing the decision, with a hearing in front of an appellate panel scheduled for November 17th. For years, scientists have conducted research on a potential connection between acetaminophen and neurodevelopmental disorders, but the studies have so far produced mixed results. Medical groups pushed back against the Trump administration's warning in September, saying that Tylenol was the only pain reliever safe for use during pregnancy to treat high fevers. If untreated, fevers can pose serious risk to the health of the baby and the mother. Molly Meegan, general counsel of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, said that the Texas lawsuit was a misrepresentation of the science. The most robust studies of the last two decades have continued to demonstrate that acetaminophen does not cause autism, and that it can play a medically important role in the care OBGYNs provide to their pregnant patients, she said. Mr. Paxton, who is challenging Senator John Cornyn, the longtime incumbent, in the Republican primary next year, has been aggressive in filing litigation that aligns with Mr. Trump's priorities. He has challenged the results of the 2020 election, sued nonprofits representing immigrants' rights, and sought to remove Democratic lawmakers from office in Texas during a battle over redistricting. Though not always successful, Mr. Paxton's legal efforts have generated deep support for him among Texas Republicans. Last month, the Food and Drug Administration said it was seeking to include a warning on the Tylenol label about the connection to neurodevelopmental disorders. Kenvue said it would oppose the changes, arguing that they were not supported by the existing science. The Trump administration and Mr. Paxton's suit both cite a recent scientific review conducted by the epidemiologists at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. That study, which evaluated existing scientific findings but did not produce new data, found evidence of a link between acetaminophen use during pregnancy and the development of autism and ADHD in childhood. More than half of the 46 studies included in the review found a positive correlation use of the drug during pregnancy and neurodevelopmental disorders in children. But scientists have cautioned that the studies do not prove that acetaminophen causes autism, which is known to be linked to a complex interplay of genetics and environmental factors. pregnant women who take acetaminophen may differ in important ways from those who don't, including in their genetics. One major study of nearly 2.5 million children born in Sweden found that, when accounting for the mother's genetics, there was no association between acetaminophen and neurodevelopmental disorders. Studies by health agencies, including the FDA and the European Medicines Agency, have evaluated the evidence and found that the results are inconclusive. On Sunday, Mr. Trump again took up the issue on his social media platform, Truth Social. Pregnant women don't use Tylenol unless absolutely necessary, uppercase, he wrote. The main law firm representing plaintiffs in the personal injury cases, Keller Postman, is also serving as outside counsel on Mr. Paxton's suit. Those plaintiff cases must clear the high bar of showing that the drug caused neurodevelopmental disorders in children and that families should be awarded damages as a result. But Mr. Paxton's suit pursues a different tack by arguing that Johnson & Johnson and Kenvue violated Texas law by not informing consumers of the possible risks of taking Tylenol during pregnancy. Texas courts are often challenging for plaintiffs in personal injury cases. Mr. Paxton's decision to file the case in a conservative rural county near the Louisiana border may have been a strategic move to find a court sympathetic to this case. Mr. Paxton's suit claims that Johnson & Johnson intentionally spun off its consumer health business, at least in part, to shield itself from liability in the cases against Tylenol. The complaint did not provide evidence for that claim. Johnson & Johnson announced the spinoff in 2021, and the split was finalized in 2023. Kenvue absorbed Johnson & Johnson's well-known and nostalgic brands like Tylenol, Band-Aid, and Johnson's Baby Shampoo. At the time, Johnson & Johnson said that it was looking to focus on its more profitable and faster-growing businesses in pharmaceuticals and medical devices. The company was also facing hugely expensive lawsuits over its role in the opioid epidemic and over accusations that talc, once used in its baby powder, had caused cancer in some customers. Wall Street analysts did not consider Tylenol to have motivated the spinoff. The Tylenol lawsuits picked up steam in 2022. Workers flood early voting sites, undecideds become prize target. More than 160,000 New Yorkers flocked to the polls this weekend to give an energetic kickoff to the start of early voting in the bitterly contested election for mayor, with the candidates' attack lines hovering over an unusual three-way race. The pace of early voting so far suggested high turnout for an off-year election, reflecting heightened interest in the contest. Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani, the Democrat nominee, has been the steady frontrunner in polls. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is running as an independent, has been running second. Curtis Sliwa, the Republican nominee and Guardian Angels founder, trails in third. Mr. Mamdani defeated a field of better-known rivals, including Mr. Cuomo, in the Democratic primary, attracting a diverse coalition of supporters through his messaging on affordability and his ability to spread that message to millions through social media. He also built a formidable base of small money donors and a grassroots ground game that swamped his rivals. That canvassing advantage was on display this weekend, even as workers backing Mr. Cuomo and Mr. Sliwa hunted for votes too. On Saturday, about 2,200 volunteers for Mr. Mamdani canvassed citywide, while another roughly 800 made calls. They included Mike Wadsworth, a public school teacher, who said he was worried about Mr. Cuomo's efforts to try to push Mr. Sliwa out of the race. Not wanting to sit on the sidelines during this perilous moment nationally, he decided to canvass for Mr. Mamdani for the first time. Mr. Woodsworth set off to canvass for a park in central Brooklyn, where later in the day, roughly 40 volunteers gathered. A choir had just serenaded many of them with songs said to be inspired by Mr. Mamdani's policies and initiatives. Some had come out for the first time. Others traveled from out of state. Some had voted in dozens of mayoral elections. Others had not voted or were ineligible. But they were all excited by Mr. Mamdani's polling lead and the prospect of electing a mayor on November 4th with a different vision for the city. To have the chance to be part of a moment that is so transformative and based on such a positive vision for the city, said Jack Littlejohn, 23, is intoxicating. About 90,000 people have volunteered for Mr. Mamdani since the campaign launched last year, with about 40,000 volunteers joining up after the primary. Volunteers supporting Mr. Mamdani have knocked on 158,000 doors since last Monday, according to the campaign. After his double-digit primary loss, Mr. Cuomo was criticized for relying too heavily on paid advertising and failing to build a grassroots operation. In recent weeks, he has tried to consolidate support among more moderate Democratic voters while also appealing to Republicans. This week, he picked up endorsements from the Staten Island Advance and the Daily News. His bid has also been supported by a patchwork of super PACs trying to drum up support, particularly in working-class neighborhoods outside Manhattan. In Brighton Beach, a conservative Brooklyn neighborhood filled with Russian-language speakers, Cuomo supporters navigated broken elevators and distrustful residents in hopes of persuading voters to abandon Mr. Sliwa and vote for the former governor, who continues to angle for Republican votes. The canvassers included Ilya Rubinstein, a Sheepshead Bay resident, who opposes Mr. Mamdani partially because of his views on Israel. In downtown Flushing, Queens, Mr. Sliwa's campaign appeared to be running the largest canvassing operation, complete with a tent, a huge poster with his headshot and a red beret, and campaign representatives handing out flyers in Chinese. Nearby, members of the Working Families Party handed out leaflets for Mr. Mamdani, and a single man distributed low-tech printouts from the Action Network Against Socialist Communism, which advertised a slate of candidates, including Mr. Cuomo. Mr. Sliwa's trademark red beret was also a major presence on the Upper West Side, where his supporters donned red berets and held signs with his name as he promenaded into the Museum of Natural Science History to cast a ballot for himself. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 29th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Elizabeth Ortel. Thank you for listening.